Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. I'm Aaron Wilson, host of the podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to various Christian leaders, discussing some of the things that have contributed to the story of their leadership, and at the same time encouraging you as you listen to reflect on your own leadership journey. If you've not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so for free on iTunes or on CastBox. Just look for the Leadership Journey Podcast, and it would be great if you were able to take a moment to leave us a review. Roz Sterling is back this week. Roz is the director of Cleopas Ministries, a ministry dedicated to helping leaders and others cultivate their spiritual lives. In this second part of the interview, Roz talks about her work in youth ministry and some of the challenges she faced in helping the church to come to terms with the challenge of a changing youth culture. She talks about her conviction of the importance of leaders paying attention to character and leading from a vibrant relationship with God. And she also talks about the challenge of singleness. Here's the podcast. Roz, welcome once again to the podcast. In our first part of our conversation, I think we got you to the just about starting the PCI yes. youth officer job.
Yes.
And you had all these adjectives to describe what an amazing and rich experience it mm-hmm. was. So I want you to talk through some of that there, what the job involved, mm-hmm. what did you do? How did some of your previous experiences help to equip you for all of that?
So yeah.
It's going to be a fairly wide-ranging question, but you can decide where you
sure.
want to start.
Sure, okay, and if I kind of rabbit on too long, you can cut in on me. Well, yes, I did use many adjectives to describe it, and I suppose really what I was doing was describing both the joy and the challenge. And I think any leadership position, those are joy and challenge would come into, I think, most people's comment on their experience of leadership and probably other things as well. So, yes, I was appointed to be in the early days. I was the youth officer for just the youth department, and then later on I became responsible for youth and children's and spent 21 years there. So how did my previous experience lead into that? Well, I've mentioned the young man in Larne, and I guess it was then I mean, God definitely put something so important in my heart at that time that coincided with my teaching in the Bible class of the need for the church to be relevant. So I arrived in this job, and I didn't have any preconceived notions as to what I would do or why I was there. In fact, in the early days, I had an awful lot of learning to do. About how the headquarters of the church functioned and what my role was and so on. But also very early on and the first year was difficult for a variety of reasons. I think any new leadership role, I suppose, is. But I think I was trying to get to grips with, well, why has God put me here? There may be a job description in front of me, which, by the way, was so long that you just got dizzy as you read it. And so, yeah, I had a job description, and I was certainly seeking to fulfil that. But the big question for me is, Lord, why am I here? What in the world have you brought me to this for? It feels like quite an interesting leap, and indeed it was. And very early on, along with some brilliant colleagues who were part of the youth board as it was at that time, I understood that here we were at a time in the life of the Christian Church in Ireland, not just the Presbyterian Church, when the culture that young people were living in bore no resemblance to how we were engaging with them in terms of Christian faith. Mm-hmm. Now, some people might say, well, why should it? Mm-hmm. For me, I became very aware, as I say, along with other brilliant colleagues, that unless we understood the influences of the culture that our young people were in, then we wouldn't have a hope of helping them to understand the relevance of the gospel. And I began to, I think, find myself running up against some of ministers and others in the church at that point, because I think they perhaps... some of them maybe misunderstood, maybe they didn't agree with me. But I think for some of them there was a sense of, well, are you saying that we have to become subservient to the culture? Well, in fact, I was saying the very opposite, that we have to understand the culture in order to be able to make the unchanging gospel of Jesus Christ something that young people can actually understand.
Right.
And so it was about contextualization, really.
Right. How did you go about that then?
Well,
presumably you had a mindset to change.
I had a mindset to change. Well, not just myself, but I was obviously part of it, myself and those around me.
How did you go about that?
How did we go about it? Well, I'll tell you a story that I think was one of the early things. I think one of the first presentations I made at the General Assembly, which was the annual, you know, conference for the church, and when every board of the church had to present what they were up to, we within the youth department produced a number of videos where we interviewed young people, and we interviewed them about the influences of their culture in terms of how they understood what their culture was telling them about sex, for example, which at that stage it was telling them, you know, unless you're sexually active, you're not at the party, and all sorts of things. And of course, that wasn't even mentioned within the church, and there was the regular, you know, relationships talk, which frankly were so, in inverted commas, and I say it kindly, laughable in the context of what young people were seeing in the culture. So we produced a number of videos and stuff, and with the help of a very good friend of mine, we presented this at the General Assembly. And somebody, one of the ministers who worked with me on the youth board at the time, said, "Ros, I think we need St John's ambulance outside the door, because there will be ministers who will be so aghast and appalled by this." And indeed, that was the case. And that was actually the start of a rather tough journey for a number of years of really trying to of changing the mindset and of using talking about youth culture, which was, to be honest, largely rejected by a lot of leaders in the church, thinking we don't need to understand youth culture, till slowly they did begin to realise we actually do need to understand youth culture if we're going to in any way be relevant in how we help young people understand the unchanging gospel. And that was nearly as difficult to get across. We weren't watering down the gospel, we weren't in any way changing the Christian message, but we were saying we need to help young people understand what it's about, but understand it with their language, understand it in terms of what the culture is telling them.
Right, and how it relates to their issues.
And how it relates to their issues, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there were quite a few years of working at that, and there was a fair amount of opposition, and then slowly there were a number of people who started to see, actually, this is right, we do need to understand this, we need to grapple with it. You know, I look back now, can't remember how long it took, but, you know, it was a gradual process. But I'm so grateful for those who caught the vision, and the vision that God gave us all together. And there were some who still would have, you know, maybe not entirely written us off, but certainly there was one minister who came to see me once, and it was kindly as he spoke to me, but he said, "You know, Ros, we didn't bring you into this job to do this." And I looked at him and I said, "Well, what is it you in inverted commas brought me in to do?" He said, "Well, we brought you in to maintain the ministry that was already there."
Ah, mm-hmm.
And in that moment I just said to him, "Well, if that's what you want, then I'm the wrong person."
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not what God has called me to do in this situation. And it wasn't just me, I don't want to individualise it only to me, but there was a growing awareness that God had a lot to help us to grapple with.
Mm-hmm.
I look back with the deepest gratitude now to those who, as I say, walked with me, who took the blows with me, and it wasn't just that I was leading the pack, we were very much equals in it. For those who, ministers who were very courageous in stepping out and letting themselves be criticised by colleagues for partnering with this, if you like, but I look back and I see, you know, the privilege of being part of a wonderful work of God that did bring about a transformation of mindset.
Did you have to? You talked in the UCCF phase about the need to learn to relate to people.
Mm-hmm.
Was any of that then relevant to you know, working in a context where yeah. you're having to change a culture.
100% yeah. relevant in that this time the relational building was with colleagues, mm-hmm. colleagues, ministerial colleagues and other colleagues. And I remember at my leaving do in Church House, one very prominent minister in the Presbyterian Church now, who bless his heart will remain nameless, but who was probably not terribly sure about what I was doing in the early days, and who at that leaving do 21 years later talked about how he very tentatively took steps because there was an era when I was known as the Moore magazine girl. Now, Moore magazine, I don't even know if it still exists, but there was a magazine called Moore that was part of youth culture at the time. There was so much being pushed into the face of young people about understanding how to be sexually together or whatever. And there was this thing in Moore magazine called The Position of the Fortnight. It was the most graphic thing you ever saw. I know. It was a diagram. It was, thankfully, a drawn thing of sexual positions. Uh-huh. And, I mean, how this magazine could ever have been on the low shelves of the newsagents is still beyond me.
Right. How did you get labelled as the Moore magazine?
Because I used it to try to help ministers understand the culture. Now, you laugh, Alan, but I remember I was invited into Union College to speak to ministers, and I took a bundle of them with me. Well, I thought I was going to need St. John's Ambulance that day as well. But also then I went to Kirk Session meetings and I gave it out. I remember going to a church in Armagh and there were these elderly members of Kirk Session. And I gave out this magazine and you could see the colour drain from some of their faces as they looked at this. But it had to be a shock tactic. Right. It had to be to help. But anyway, I'm getting off your question, which was about relationships. But in those, after we got past the shock bit, and some of them got really angry with me, what are you bringing this pornography in here for? And I would say to them, actually, guys, this is the whole point. This is not pornography, according to where the newsagents have it on their stand. Every single young person from as young as anything could pick this up off the newsagent's stand and leaf through it and see this. And so I suppose through the shock tactic of using that magazine, and it was terribly shocking to a lot of people, but also then following through with it and saying, now, having looked at that, can you understand what it is that I'm trying to say to you about the culture our young people are, the mindset that's being created for them? And if you stand up and say to a young person, now, fidelity in relationships is part of the Christian message, they will laugh at you. And Christian young people are so compromised by it because they're sitting in their classes and their classmates are talking openly about this, and many of them no doubt talking about stuff that didn't happen, but we know that's part of the discovering who you are as a sexual person as a teenager. But young people, Christian young people sitting there thinking, how do I talk about my faith in the midst of this? And we weren't, as a church, equipping them to understand how to do it. So I've gone off the relational thing again.
Yeah, just the relational thing. How do you combine having a conviction about what you think needs to be done, and facing opposition, maintaining your conviction, and yet being courteous and winning people over by how you relate to them?
Well, there were a number of things. There were a number of people who were within the leadership, and by leadership I mean the broad sense of ministers and elders and everybody within the denomination, who were very openly opposed to the direction that they felt that I was the person behind leading youth and children thinking. And they remained so till I left. And sadly, I have to say, some of them were anything but courteous to me. And some of them used my gender, for example, to try to sideline me. Now, early on, I could hear my dad died the first year I was in that job, which was one of the deepest sadnesses to me. Maybe it was the second year, I can't remember. He was so proud of the fact that I had been appointed to it. And he said to me, just give people a laugh. He said to me, now, I have something I want you to promise to do just before I start. I said, what would that be? And I knew him well enough to be very careful before I said, oh, absolutely. And he said, well, you have to promise for it. I said, no, we don't do it that way, Dad. Anyway, it was that I wouldn't wear a short skirt. That I wouldn't destroy my opportunity by wearing a short skirt. Well, I didn't wear short skirts, but anyway, that's an aside. That was part of the fun bit of Dad. But sadly, he died. I think it was, would you say, 94. He died in 94, and I started in 92. So it was only a year and a bit after it started, and that was a huge sadness to me. But one of the things I early on in the first 6 months realized. Okay, there are certain things here that are not my battle, and my gender wasn't one of them. No matter how much people tried to make it the battle, I sidestepped it every time. Now, God gave me a very clear sense of that. And that helped me, I think, enormously. Now, I did have to let a lot of things roll off my back in regard to it, because there were some who did use it. Not many, but there were some who certainly used it. And some who, a lot who then used the fact that they felt that this whole understanding of youth culture was just, was wrong, or I don't know what they thought, because they never came to talk to me about it. And there was one of the sadnesses. Mm. I picked things up that were said behind my back but weren't said to my face. And that, if there's anything for leaders that I think is so important, if you disagree with a fellow leader, go and talk to them face to face. Do not talk about them behind their back. I heard so many things come back about what was said about me, and some of them were pretty rough and were totally distorted, because the person had never come to speak to me. Now, the minister who did come to speak to me and say to me, this is what you're here to do, I admire him greatly to this day. I didn't agree with him, but I admire him. So at a leadership level, if you disagree, and scripture spells that out so clearly, go and speak to the person. Do not ever talk about them behind their back within the Christian community. So the relational thing, Alan, sorry, I'll say something very quickly about that. Because I sidestepped some of the issues that could have taken me down complete rabbit warrens, then I was able to, and I would have said to people, if they did say to my face, what are you doing, or we don't agree with this, and of course there were things they were very supportive about, I don't want to make a drama out of the thing, but when people didn't disagree, I said, well, can we talk about it? You know, sit down and talk with me about it. Tell me why you think that this shouldn't be the emphasis. And so that was where the relational thing definitely won people over. Most definitely did. And the same for me. I'm not trying to say that I was the one who had it all right. Not by a long shot. I learned a lot from them, and I learned a lot from them in terms of what they were dealing with in a local church. But it was a slow process, but a very, very important one.
So 21 years you were there. How did you know it was time to leave then? And why Cleopas?
Well, I talked earlier about being very passionate about things God calls me to, and I thank God. I want to say something about call here. I was very blessed by being very clear about the call of God. And in one of your former podcasts, somebody did speak about struggling with that. And I listened to that with great interest, and actually with great gratefulness to God. Because I was always very clear that God had put me in these places. And that was my salvation when it was rough. And it was rough in nearly everything that I did, that I knew that God had called me to it. But also I said earlier about being very passionate. And my passions then did lead me to get burnt out. So again, PCI, I didn't learn from my time in UCCF, but once we sort of broke through in this thing of trying to help people to understand why culture and understanding culture was so important, along with all the other things about nurturing young people and so on, but this was a big one. I, of course, poured myself into it with every ounce I had, and reached a point 10 years in when I was pretty dry. But the thing about when you do that is you often don't recognise it yourself. And that's where you need other godly leaders to come alongside and say, Roz, can we have a chat? And that happened for me in the form of a man called Mike Giaconelli. Mike headed up a ministry in America called Youth Specialties, and by this stage we had developed a relationship with them, and they were coming, some of their team were coming backwards and forwards to lead youth leadership trainings, events and stuff. So it was on one of those occasions about 10 years into my time, and we were sitting having dinner, and Mike was a kind of in-your-face, what we might unkindly class a classic American, and he just announced at the table loudly to me, "When is this church going to give you a sabbatical, Roz?" And I about fell off a chair, because people who worked in Church House weren't sort of seen as those who needed sabbaticals at that time. But I thank God for the person who was the chair of our board at that stage, the lovely James Hindman, and James answered for me. He said, "If you give her something to do, Mike, she can go on sabbatical." And so I didn't even have to answer for myself. So he invited me to go the following spring to Sabbath Retreat. And the name sounded wonderful, but also scary as anything. So I was whisked away off to California, and I said I did a degree in geography, and my subject was geography, and one of the things I'd always wanted to see was the Golden Gate Bridge. Well, I got to see the Golden Gate Bridge. But we were handpicked. There were a group of us who were handpicked by Mike through the various networks he had in ministry to go on this five-day retreat. And I can say with great humility, it changed my life. It stopped me in my tracks. It made me, God held a mirror in front of my face. He let me see how busy and driven my life had become. He allowed me to take a long, hard look at myself, which would not have been nearly as effective if I had been still in my home working context. And I realised my soul was very dry, that I wasn't ministering out of a deep, personal, intimate, joyous relationship with God. I was ministering out of my own sense of what was right and wrong. Now, a lot of it was okay, and God in his mercy, you know, I hadn't lost the faith or anything, but in terms of walking deeply with God, that certainly had lost its edge. And so that retreat truly changed my life. It stopped me. The big thing about being busy and driven, and so many Christian leaders are busy and driven, and I was one of them, and God stopped me in my tracks and said, "This is not how I want it to be, and secondly, it doesn't have to be like this."
Mm-hmm. Is that part of the idea of Cleopas?
It is, very much. It was the genesis of Cleopas. Mm-hmm. Now, I was another 10 years, 11 years in Church House after that, but it started a whole new way of relating, and I was responsible at that time for a team of people, there were probably up to 17 people for whom I was in the form of a manager at the time. And so I began, when I came back, I first of all determined I would live my life very differently, that this, you know, because I saw very clearly that often the drivenness was by all the agendas that other people put on me, both within the job. Now, there are things you have to do as part of your job, sure. But that there were agendas that I took up, and if somebody put something in front of me and said, "Roz, you need to," then I would respond, and I would think, "Well, how do I do this?" Instead of stepping back and saying, "Well, is that where God's at work at the minute? Is that what God is actually doing?" So it really was a life-changing week. And so I began to lead my team differently, to try to encourage in them a much slower pace. Now, not a less effective pace, because in fact that was the secret, that the more they took time, and we took time together to try to listen for where God was leading us, where he was at work, but the wholeness of the person became so much more important. I remember before I went on that retreat, somebody came into the office in Church House one day, and I was in the general office, and this person knew me fairly well, and they'd come in to pick up a resource, and they looked over and they said, "Oh, Roz, the busiest person I know." Well, I didn't take that as a badge of honour. I was horrified. The busiest person they knew. So what did that say? That I had no time for people. I had no time. So it just, God really showed me how this is not how he wants leaders within the church to be.
This, some of these things then became part of how you led your team, things that you were learning yourself. That then eventually has become the whole focus of your ministry,
is
helping people to lead people in that way. Talk to us about the transition then between your time at PCI and moving into Clear Pass. I know it wasn't a straightforward transition. It didn't go according to plan.
No, it didn't. When I was appointed to the job in PCI, I knew that it was probably a slightly more long-haul job than some of the others, which I'd done for maybe 4 or 5 years or 2 or 3 years. But after that, after a few years post that retreat, I began to feel deeply passionate about this whole thing of helping leaders to understand the need for their own soul care, to use a phrase, and felt the sense of a growing call to it. Tried a couple of times to sort of get a ministry going. Well, before I suppose I tried to get a ministry going on my own, I was invited to join a ministry called Renovare, which had been established by Richard Foster, who wrote Celebration of Discipline, a book that was way before its time, because I remember as a student myself, I was studying it and reading it, and then when I came back to it years later, I thought, why did it not change my life then, you know? So I was invited through a friend that I had known from my UCCF days to get involved with Renovare, and I was very excited by that. I thought that that was going to be a vehicle for the passion, the new passion that was growing in me about leaders and caring for their own spiritual well-being. I thought that was going to be the vehicle for it here, because as I watched myself and had to go through that process myself through the retreat and subsequent to the retreat, I just watched the leaders around me and I realised many of them falling like flies through stress. And if you looked at what caused that stress, well, yes, there might have been an incident that was a focus, but actually the real reason was because their inner resources were so depleted.
Yeah.
And so increasingly I had this sense of God calling me to be involved somehow. Never in the early days thought I'd be establishing a ministry, but as I say, I thought Renovare would be the vehicle. But for various reasons that wasn't the case, and I was on the board for a short time of Renovare and then realised that's not the route within the call that God has put in me, and so I stepped off the board and was kind of a wee bit sort of in limbo about it all for maybe a year or so. And then just slowly began to feel, no, I need to establish something here, and that's where I think I will end up. So I started to try to do that while I was still working at PCI, and then developed ME, and that knocked the stuffing completely out of me. I had 2 years of being very ill, and which of course knocked on the head anything. And those again were very formative years, because I knew this deep growing passion in me to establish something. And yet I remember at one point during one of my worst days with the ME, crying to God and saying, Lord, how in the world could I ever do this now? I can barely walk to the bathroom without being exhausted. And it was a very challenging time, but it was, again, in God's hands, a hugely important time, because it stripped away any sense of me being important. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean, of course I'm important, I'm a child of God, I'm precious and honoured in His sight, I'm loved, I feel more loved by God today than ever before in my life, I know my value and my worth. But what it stripped away was the whole idea that I had to make it happen. That actually in all ministry, what we need to do is recognize we are nothing more than a vehicle for the work of the Holy Spirit of God. And so many of us as leaders, and I was so guilty of it at times, even in the midst of my passion about things, we get in God's way. We don't take time to stop and say, okay, Lord, what is it you want to do here? Because all I am is a vehicle. And all I want to be is a vehicle. So,
Can I just pause for a second?
Please.
I think there's something that's worth it is worth just flagging. Is this, you know, balance between having a strong sense of worth,
mm-hmm.
but a low sense of importance?
Absolutely. That's it in a nutshell. Mm. It's a very strong sense of worth, a very rooted sense of belonging to God, being valued and loved, but even more than that, a hugely rooted sense of well-being that I am to God precious. Everything about me matters to Him. But in a call to ministry, what was the phrase you used? A low sense of importance.
High sense
exactly.
of value, low sense of
exactly.
importance. Yeah.
Philippians 2. What does it tell us about Jesus who set aside in that song His majesty? You know, the issue of humility for Christian leaders, and I say this to myself every day because our old nature will make us feel more important than we ought to and will get in the way of recognizing I am at the end of the day His humble servant and only what He will do through me will be of any use for the kingdom and for the lives of those that I'm called to serve. Now, what I would say about that is that you can recognize that in your head, but it's got to travel from your head into your being so that it becomes a part of who you are. And that only happens bit by bit, because it's part of a letting go of the old nature, the self-reliance of the old nature that that we just default to, and by defaulting to it then we live out of it, whereas God is saying no, let go, give it to me, let me work through you. And the joy of doing that is wonderful.
There must also have been a tension between having this sense of excitement and passion about a new ministry, and yet wondering if you'd ever be able to.
That was a huge conflict in those days when I was so unwell. Actually, even never mind the sense of a new ministry, it was the sense of my life as I knew it felt over in the early days when I was lying in bed and could barely walk the length of, as I say, from my bed to the bathroom. It was deeply challenging. Deeply, deeply challenging, and a very painful and lonely place to be. But
you mentioned to me once a book that you had read.
Yep.
That you found very helpful. Can you just remind me and tell our listeners what that
and
book is?
Indeed, that book was called When the Heart Waits by Sue Monk Kidd, and that book God put in my hands at that time, and I didn't have great concentration, but I'm sure throughout those 2 years I read that book 3 times.
Right.
It was the one that really gave me a sense of no matter what happens, first of all, that God was forming me through this, and I had to trust Him that He was, that there was a purpose to being in this, because either God is sovereign or He's not, and trusting Him that there was a purpose in this, but that was an active decision that I had to, and that I suppose the book helped me to understand that. Many, many other things in that book, but it also was a time I think when God took me deeply into questions about my character and who I was, and I guess that. I'm kind of thinking out loud as I say this to you now, but perhaps in those days of when it felt like everything had been stripped away, that was when God probably began to do a very deep work in me in terms of recognition of needing to allow Him to transform me.
So obviously that's a huge, the huge challenge of illness, particularly such a long time, raised so many questions. Looking back over various phases of your ministry and leadership, what are some of the big challenges that you've experienced, some of the big challenges that you think leaders need to be facing up to and being honest about?
I've talked a lot about character, and by that I mean recognizing the struggle between the old and new nature, and recognizing the need for God, for us to be open to God to transform us. Dallas Willard has a great phrase about this. He talks about we need to recognize that we need to open ourselves to the work of the Holy Spirit, but actually only the grace of God will do the work. And he talks about how grace is God doing in us what we cannot do for ourselves, but we need to open ourselves to the work of that grace, and that grace is much more than just bringing us into the kingdom in the first place, that we need grace to be active in our lives moment by moment. And God, I suppose, as I look back, I see used a number of journeys within my own personal life, I suppose, to form me deeply. And one of them was the journey of being single, and that was a deep a deeply painful and challenging experience for me, as was the issue of motherhood. I'd had a very special relationship when I was at university, and it didn't go the route of marriage, and that was broke my heart for quite a long time. It took me a long time to get over that. But it also probably left me feeling very vulnerable about how to relate to potential, you know, men in regard to relationships or whatever. I related very well to those that was safe to relate to. Excuse me. So increasingly, the fact that marriage didn't come my way became a very, very painful issue. And then in my early 30s, I discovered that even if I did marry, I would never be a mother. And that became another deeply painful experience. And I felt as if God had snatched from me two things that I would have longed for.
How did you work through that then?
With a lot of tears, is the honest truth, with a lot of oscillating between being very angry with God, blaming God, and then asking Him to forgive me. And I think that cycle went on for a very long time. But every time that cycle went on, when I would seek His forgiveness for being angry, or I remember one time driving down the Craig Road, and I was in my angry phase with God, and I pulled myself up to my full height in the seat, and I hope I was paying attention to the road at the same time, and saying out loud in the car, "Right, I'm going home to burn every Christian book I have."
Oh.
No, thank God I didn't do it. But that was the phase of being, I've had enough, God. This hurts so much. I've had enough. And so there was a long time of that. But what God was doing, and which I couldn't see at the time, was that He was graciously holding on to me and allowing me to go to those depths of pain so that He could then reveal Himself to me. And I often say that that experience became the anvil upon which He formed me. And I know it's true. And I was talking to a group recently about this, who asked me about what was one of the biggest challenges. And dealing with being single was one of them. And I actually said to this group, and I thought, gosh, Lord, thank You for giving that to me. Because they asked me, well, what sense do you make of it now? Or how did you move to a place of being at peace about it now? And I said, my answer to them was, I slowly realised that as I berated God and then cried out to Him and asked Him, that my fist was tightly closed. And I was saying, Lord, only by You supplying my need through giving me a husband or whatever will this be resolved. And God had to say to me, open your fist and trust me. And when I reached the point of saying, Lord, at last I'm prepared to trust You with this pain. It wasn't trust You to give me a husband. It wasn't trust You to give me children. It was, I'm prepared to trust You, full stop. And that was the turning point. That was the point at which He really used that in a deep way. And I want to say very quickly something about how within the community of the church there's a huge responsibility to walk with one another, whatever the pain is. There are a lot of childless Christian couples out there. And I don't speak very often about this in public, but I did once in a church service, and I talked about how when I discovered that I was not medically going to be able to ever have children, probably never could have had children, but didn't know it until my early 30s. And I was in hospital and facing the perspective, or the prospect rather, of a hysterectomy. And my younger sister came in. She was training as a nurse at the time. And she sat with me and we cried together and she prayed with me. And when she left the hospital that day, she prayed that if God ever gave her the gift of children, they would become the gift of children to me. This is the point I get emotional, because how God has answered that prayer is phenomenal. And those children have blessed me with the joy of them growing up, because they now, the two of them are now at university, but all three of them used to come into my house every day after school, because they got the bus in my village and then they came to my house afterwards. And other things, and And I have other nieces and nephews who are very, very precious to me as well. But they weren't. I was in England at the time when they were young and stuff, so I didn't develop quite the same relationship. But these children, it was the prayer that my sister prayed that was so insightful. And I said when I spoke about this in the church, I said, now that may have been my blood sister, but we are brothers and sisters in Christ. How do we walk alongside one another in these deep areas of pain? And I will say very carefully and with no sense of agenda or bitterness, but as a church, we need to have a theology of singleness.
Right, okay. Yeah, that's a, I mean, obviously that's a huge subject.
Huge. But,
and without wanting to, you know, oversimplify it, what would be a couple of things that you would say to the church in terms of how to relate to single people?
I think the first thing I would say is, please, as leaders, pay more attention to how you present the idea of church family. Mm-hmm. Because so often the idea of church family is mum, dad and 2.2 kids. And the activities that we do and the mindset unconsciously is about family. Now, not just people like me who are single, but people who are parents without children. That is deeply painful. I'll give you a wee example of something that happened once. Now, this person apologised to me afterwards because they realised. But I remember coming into church one Easter Sunday, and I'm not great at timekeeping, as anybody who knows me and is listening to this will tell you. And so I was right on the moment of the start of the service, and I walked in to the vestibule, and the person giving out the orders of service said to me, "Ros, do you mind if I keep this last order of service for a whole family?" They might as well have slapped me in the face. I went in and I could feel the tears rising within me, and I was in a very happy mood that day, and I slid into the back pew and I started to sob uncontrollably, and it just opened up wounds that were desperate of. And the person came to me after the service and said, "I am so sorry for saying that to you." Thankfully, the person realised, but many a person wouldn't have. They wouldn't have really understood what that comment did. Now, I want to be very careful here. I don't want to create a poor old me syndrome for single people or parent, or, you know, couples without children. But in answer to your question, I think we need to look at how we seriously create church family. How do we create the sense of family? There are some single people who would be horrified to actually probably listen to what I'm saying, because they would think, we don't want anybody to notice that we're single, we just want to be left alone. Well, in a sense, they're absolutely right. We want to just be integrated as part of a family. But churches need to just be aware of how they do that.
Yeah.
And create a much bigger understanding of what family is, because it's not just mum, dad and kids. It is who we are as a body of Christ and how we serve one another. Now, every church needs to work that out for themselves. I'm glad to say the one I go to is doing a pretty good job of it. There's still times when, I mean, I've just talked about an incident in my own church, but that was a pretty unexpected one-off, I think. And as I say, that person recognised. And that the reason they recognise is because there is a culture within the church of trying to create a different mindset.
And I guess, too, singleness happens to different people in different ways.
Yeah.
There are some who've never married, and then there are also those who've been married.
Who've been bereaved,
you know, or bereavement or divorced.
Or divorced or whatever.
And perhaps they find it very difficult walking into an environment on their own.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you another one that's really, really important at the minute. People who are of homosexual orientation and who are coming into a church seeking sanctuary, and of course there's a huge debate going on. Many Christians who feel that it's okay to be in this place of same-sex relationships, that's not a position I hold. But there are many people who are in our churches for whom their orientation is that they are gay. They are not in relationships, they're not seeking to be in relationships. But the level of pain and hurt that I know a number of those people have gone through, first of all in trying to come to grips with who they discover themselves to be, but also how do they find a place in the church, and can they speak openly about who they are without being judged? That's another whole area And of course the culture now in our society is throwing up all sorts of issues in regard to that, but we need to understand how to walk together as communities where we truly love one another. And that was Jesus's last statement to his disciples in John 15. You must love one another. We need to learn how to love one another, discover what it means to love one another. And it doesn't mean that we all become the same in how we think or breathe, or it means we learn to love one another in all of our diversity.
Yeah. Last few minutes, Ros, I want you to two or three of the main things that leaders listening to this, challenges that they need to be aware of, lessons that you have learned that you think, this is so important to share this with other people. Give us two or three of those.
Well, I'm going to go back to the thing of their character, my character. I think that I see increasingly that unless we are attentive to the development of Christian character, especially as a leader, and I mean, we don't have to look very far to see some of the recent huge moral failures. Satan will use the weaknesses. We need to know our weak areas. You know, I hear about Christian leaders who get caught up with pornography quietly and silently. If you're doing that, you need to stop instantly and find help. We need to be, Psalm 25 talks about, with integrity and uprightness I will serve the Lord. So the first thing I would say is we need to have utter integrity about who we are, about our character in every corner. Are you a good husband? Are you a good wife? Is the person that your church sees a very different person to the one you are at home? Well, that shouldn't be. And so we need to seek the grace of God for character transformation. I've talked about my struggle of being single, but twice I nearly fell morally because the opportunity was in front of me. And I'll say very quickly, one of the things that saved me on that occasion was there was one situation where a married man within a context in which I was working was paying me far too much attention. I knew there was an attraction there. There was an attraction that grew in me. And I prayed and prayed and said, Lord, Lord, I don't want to be one of these leaders that falls. And the more I prayed, the more I fancied him, you know, and the more I wanted to spend time with him. And I was distraught. I was ready for a psychiatric institution. And I just feared greatly that I was going to fall. And I said, Lord, what am I to do? I remember one day, and then I decided, I wouldn't even say that God told me to do this, although I'm sure he pushed me in the direction of it. I decided to tell a close Christian friend and ask her to pray with me. And when I declared that openly to that friend, the power of it disappeared, like snow of a ditch that the sun was melting it. The grip of it was gone. And then I began to look at the person and think, oh, right, well, I'm very glad you're with that lady, not me. So moral character, you know, it's well documented of, I'll not mention his name, but a recent Christian leader who for years was held up as an icon. And he was morally off the rails throughout the entire time that he was in leadership. I think if I had one thing to say to leaders, look at your moral character and go before God and bend at knee and say, Lord, purify my heart.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Or
be honest about, be honest with yourself, I think. I talked earlier there about not being a great timekeeper. And actually, I remember something you and I were involved in when I was a bit late.
But that was to do with a dog, wasn't it?
It was to do with a dog. But now you're letting me off the hook here, Alan. You're not supposed to be letting me off the hook. I think be honest with yourself about your weaknesses. And the timekeeping thing may seem like a small thing, but it wasn't. It had a huge impact on people. And I used to make all manner of excuses. And God just pulled me up by my socks one day and said, Get it sorted. Stop making excuses. Because the impact you're having on other people. What else would I say to leaders in a positive? I would say enjoy God through and through. Get to a place where you love Jesus for all the wonderful reasons that you should love him. Now, we have to grow in that. We're back to this relational thing, that our relationship with God must be central absolutely central. And if time with God, and this is why Cleopas exists, if time with God is not happening, then get it sorted. Get into a quiet place with him and listen to him and allow him to feed your soul. Jesus talked about the rivers of living water flowing through us. Here's my swan song for folks listening to me. Are the rivers of living water thrilling you and flowing through you? Because if they're not, just stop what you're doing and go get it sorted.
Great way to finish, Rose. And we've kind of gone full circle because we started with Cleopas. And,
we did.
And you've come right back to the heart of what you're doing. Thank you so much for the time that you've given.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Both of these weeks. And God bless you as you continue to seek to resource leaders. We'll mention the website and point people in that direction as well. But thank you. God bless you.
My privilege, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for taking the time to listen to the Leadership Journey podcast, and thanks to Ross for taking the time to talk to us. If you'd like to contact Ross and find out about some of the opportunities that are offered by Cleopas, you can contact her on the Cleopas website. That's cleopas.net. Next time, my guest will be Brendan Healy. Brendan lives in Mullingar in the centre of Ireland, and he's a retired Lieutenant Colonel in the Irish Army. You won't want to miss his story, so be sure to join us again next time. And in the meantime, have a good week.